Hey, Nikki.
Hi there, Mikey.
How are you?
I'm so good. I'm so excited. How are you?
I am excited and I'm doing good and I'm ready to get started on our first episode of Behind the Lens with Mikey and Nikki. How about you?
Outstanding. I've been rearing and raring to go.
Right on. Well, today is going to be a real fun podcast because today we are talking about the works of Quentin Tarantino.
Absolutely, we are. And I have to ask, man, where were you when you discovered Tarantino? Like, what was the one thing that hit you like, this is a
For me, it was Reservoir Dogs. I was about 22 years old. It came out on video cassette, VHS. And I remember taking it home, putting it in, and just being stunned. Just being absolutely stunned when Steeler's Wheel starts playing halfway through the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And there, Steeler's Wheel stuck in the middle with you, and Stephen Wright is announcing the song for K-Billy Radio.
K Billy Super Sounds of the 70s coming
That's
at you.
right. And he announces that, and that cop gets his ear taken off by Michael Madsen. And Michael Madsen, in beautiful Quentin Tarantino style, puts the ear up to his mouth and says, "Can you hear me?"
Which I think you just nailed his sense of humor that goes throughout every single one of his
Right.
films. But Reservoir was legendary. You know, we were coming out of the 80s at that point where a lot of film was either Spielberg or it was Porky's or Ski Patrol or all of these types of films. And the 90s hit and we had this auteur filmmaker coming out at Sundance Film Festival, right? And we hadn't seen anything like it. It was so stylistic, right, Mikey?
Right.
I mean, everything in Reservoir was just very gritty, but a certain polish to it, a very, very cool aesthetic. And it was about the dialogue, wasn't it?
It was totally about the dialogue. It was about the dialogue, but there was also these interesting things that he did that I had never experienced before. And like I'll give you a for instance, when at the
Yes.
beginning of the movie, and by the way, this is everything that we talk about with actors and with filmmakers and with all these different things, it's all spoilers. So if you haven't seen these movies,
Oh,
if
gosh.
you haven't seen these movies, I'm sorry, but we're gonna talk about the content of the movies.
Yeah.
So but anyway, in Reservoir Dogs, one of the things that really struck me, and it was the first time I think I'd ever seen it, was when they did the bank robbery. And when they leave the bank robbery and they're having the shootout, there's no soundtrack,
Right.
which made it so real and so gritty. And that's just such a hallmark of Tarantino.
Oh, absolutely. I can vividly remember the scene right now, as soon as you said that, where Harvey Keitel is talking to Tim Roth and he's screaming, "You're gonna be
Right.
okay. You're gonna be
And he even
okay."
sings it, right? You're gonna be
Oh,
okay.
yeah.
You're gonna be okay.
It's his gangster lullaby
Right.
to the kid who's dying in the back.
Right. Now, how about you,
It
Nikki? What was your first moment where you went, whoa, with Quentin Tarantino?
you know, mine's a little off, and I say just a little off only because it wasn't a film he directed. But I'm such a screenwriter connoisseur, devourer, however you want to say it, that for me it was True Romance, which was his first screenplay, which he actually took the money and proceeds from that screenplay and was able to finance Reservoir Dogs. And so for me, it was all about True Romance. I had never heard dialogue like that. I had never, this was back in 93. So to give, you know, timeline, you've got Reservoir Dogs. in 96. So back in 93 is when True Romance hits the scene. And you've got Alabama Whirly,
right?
I mean, just the name alone, you see Patricia Arquette immediately in your head.
Yeah.
Right? With the tight skirt and the blonde flip. And you've got Christian Slater with the Elvis glasses on. And you've got this bizarre love story that has everyone from gangster Christopher Walken with Dennis Hopper playing Christian Slater's dad to Brad Pitt, burnout stoner,
right,
as Floyd,
right,
to Michael Rappaport to Bronson Pinchot from Perfect Strangers.
How crazy was that, by the way?
Right? Right? Middleman drug dealer, and you're like, this is something I've never seen. You've got James Gandolfini in one of his major gangster roles where he beats the crap out of Alabama Whirly, and you've got Vengeance Aside going on with this beautiful scene where she takes she takes a wine opener and just stabs him in the foot. I mean, you've got blood, you've got gore, you've got guts, but you also have Christian Slater talking to his mentor Elvis, played by Val Kilmer,
right,
in the mirror, and these really bizarre, twisted scenes of cool, slick dialogue. And it's, you know, Drexel in the corner, but played by Gary Oldman, who is a Rasta drug dealer. And it really, for me, was a dialogue that was so quick, smart, and witty and gritty. We've never seen anything like that before.
Absolutely.
It just came out of nowhere, like hit you in the mouth, and you just went, oh my God, this is a love story? That's your envisionment of a love story.
Yes.
I'm in. Okay. This is definitely not Say Anything.
Yes, know? Absolutely. It's not Say Anything. And you know, I've got an interesting story about True Romance and Quentin writing it. He told a story about how he went to see the film and he took a date. There was a first date. And he told the girl that he had written the movie. And she said, well, let's tell the people at the box office so that they'll let us in for free. And so you have to hear Quentin tell the story, but he's like, and so we walk up to the box office, and I told him, I said, my name is Quentin Tarantino, and I wrote this movie, and can we get in for free? And sure enough, he looked at the poster, and there's my name on it, and we got in for free. You know, and
oh my God,
it's just such a great story, you know, about him writing True Romance. But
you know, number one, you nailed him, by the way. You nailed that.
He's so manic, right?
Okay. He's so all over the place, but that's just it about his films. I mean, his brain is up on the screen, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean, and he hops genres, and you don't see that a lot with a lot of directors, right? I mean, you see certain ones that'll do that, but you've got this guy that's either doing a twisted Romeo and Juliet True Romance story to Inglourious Basterds reimagining history. I'm sorry, what?
And we'll get to Inglourious Basterds, but I think the one that we need to move on to next is the creme de la creme.
Oh, are we starting to talk about PF?
Oh, we're talking about PF. Now, I have a funny story about Pulp Fiction. I went to see Pulp Fiction with a few friends.
Okay.
The scene where Christopher Walken says, the only place you could keep it, his ass. When he's talking to a young Bruce Willis.
Yep.
I laughed so hard, Nikki. And I what was really embarrassing about it was I was laughing long after the theater was. So the theater had laughed and then they moved on. But it kept replaying in my head as I'm watching the film and I'm still laughing. And And so, I remember the only second point that I wanted to make about Pulp Fiction that was interesting, you know, as a personal story, was that when it ended, I wanted to stay and watch it again.
Oh yeah,
it was just that good.
Oh, I went to go see that film at least 4 times in the theater because I had never seen such a film that was done storytelling wise in a non-linear way.
Uh-huh.
Where I left that theater and went, hold on, when did John Travolta die? When did that happen?
Right.
It took me several times going back, watching. Okay.
Right.
Now I get it. And I watching Pulp Fiction, and it was cool and it was funny and it was these mesmerizing scenes. Who is ever going to forget Uma Thurman being revived?
That was the scene I was just thinking of, Nikki. I was just thinking of that. And you know,
yeah,
it's interesting.
Yeah,
it's interesting because as a screenwriter, you know that I, for people that don't know, I also am a screenwriter. And as a screenwriter, there are certain rules to crafting a story. And one of the main rules is that you have intent and obstacle. So in each scene, a character needs to want something and there needs to be something that gets in the way. And in that particular scene, John Travolta needed to get Uma Thurman to what was the redhead's name? The guy that they went to.
In that scene? Okay, so in that scene in Pulp Fiction, that was actually played by Rosanna Arquette, and she was Jody.
Okay, but her boyfriend, Eric.
Oh, Eric Stoltz.
Eric Stoltz.
And that was Lance.
Right. Okay. So the deal is that he is trying to get to Lance's house, and the obstacle is Lance. Down to the point where when the phone rings, he takes forever to pick the phone up, and Travolta's going,
"Oh yeah,
answer, Lance, answer." You know, and it takes him forever to answer the phone. And when he does answer the phone, he casually goes, "Hello." And from that point forward, it's just a intent and obstacle playground of what needs to get done and the things that are coming between it. And that was just that scene. When you're watching it in the theater for the first time and he puts that red Sharpie around her heart for the adrenaline injection. I mean, you're coming out of your skin.
Because you know what's happening. It's the anticipation. And there's that quick cut scene where you see the sweat dripping.
Right.
Just waiting. And he holds the camera angle just to wait for that anticipation moment.
Yes.
And then boom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was as Arquette said, that was trippy.
Oh yeah. Oh my God, she was so good in that.
She was great in it.
That's just it. He has the most iconic scenes. I can say, especially I feel like Pulp Fiction's his most quotable, hands down across the board.
I agree.
But I can tell you right now, as soon as I say these next couple phrases to you, you're going to have an image pop in your head. And that is the perfect example of his type of screenplay.
Let's do it.
So, for example, if I tell you, Mikey, bring out the gimp. That's right?
Yes.
You knew exactly what I was talking about.
I mean, instantly.
Yes. There's no mistaking that.
No.
There's no mistaking that.
And that's what's incredible about Tarantino as well, is he becomes ingrained in pop culture. I mean, he creates pop culture, you know, and Bring Out the Gimp is a perfect example. And the other thing about it is he's such a great craftsman when it comes to dialogue, but what about his music choices? What do you think every time you hear Al Green, Let's Stay Together?
Marcellus Wallace, baby.
Marcellus Wallace. I see a Band-Aid every time I hear that song.
Oh, yeah.
I see a Band-Aid on the back of Marcellus Wallace's head, you know?
Absolutely. And what do you think about when you hear Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon by Urge Overkill?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's 100% being played on a record player in a beautiful home somewhere in Los Angeles. And, you know, that's the impression that you are left with. You know, you hear those songs and those songs just bring it right back to you.
And that was when, and going back, just like you were saying with Reservoir Dogs, he did the same thing with that. There was a lot of absenteeism in Reservoir where there was silent cuts. However, when he did choose to play a song, it was very specific for the scene. But on top of that, throughout the entire Reservoir Dogs, you have Kay Billy's Super Sounds of the 70s and Stephen Wright's voice coming over. Just as in Pulp Fiction, in each segment, there was a very specific song that he chose to play.
Right.
And, you know, and he does that through all of his films, which is, it just blows my mind because he's got his hand in every single one of the pots, and you don't have a lot of artists, because I do consider what he does artistry.
Right.
You don't have a lot of artists that covers the screenplay, acts in the film, is doing the directing, has his hand in the music. I mean, this man, this is his brain, because he doesn't, you know, and it's crafting the story to him is the full picture. And I have a lot of respect for that. You don't have that with every single director. He is unique in that way.
And if you're listening and you've never seen Pulp Fiction, that's what you need to do today, is you need to see Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
That is a movie that everybody needs to see.
Oh, yeah, because Honey Bunny and Pumpkin will stick in your brain.
I mean, and you know what I thought was brilliant about Honey Bunny and Pumpkin was, and I'm always going to refer to Nikki because she will always know actors and who they are. So who plays Honey Bunny?
It's Amanda
Plummer. Look at you. God, that's great. I wish I could do that. But I thought that her dialogue, ante up, you old effing pricks, move, or I'll execute every mother effing one of you. And she goes, that dialogue is just amazing. That's just amazing dialogue. Now, skipping ahead, let's skip ahead a little bit.
You bet.
Jackie Brown was not my favorite Quentin Tarantino movie. I enjoyed it. I don't own it. I enjoyed it, but it just, there were scenes that I thought were great in Jackie Brown. How about you?
Okay.
What about you?
See, Jackie Brown for me was one of the most underrated he's ever done. And at the time when it came out, I loved that because it was Quentin being a little silent. You know, here's the deal. It was an adaptation of Elmore Leonard's book. And the first times he had done that, right? So he did more of an adaptation of the original screenplay. And so you have Leonard's Brooks out there, you know, they did remakes of Out of Sight, and all this kind of, so he has a very certain feel for writing. And I thought Quentin did, again, and I'll say this again and again about Tarantino, a great homage to that style of writing, but just implemented his storytelling, editing, and really focus on it. You had this great performance by Pam Grier and Robert Farr. You had Michael Keaton coming out of nowhere, and I missed seeing Michael Keaton. And that's something that Quentin does. He did with Travolta. He absolutely did with, and again, in Jackie Brown, he brought Michael Keaton back to the fold. He brought Bridget Fonda, Pam Grier, Robert Foster. He's taking.
See, now you're making me want to see it again. Now you do make me want to see it again.
Well, here's the deal. When you originally said you weren't into it, I kind of wanted to reach across the phone and shake you. But here's the deal. If I can convince you otherwise, then I don't have to shake you, which is awesome.
Yeah, I think you're convincing me. Now, the one scene that I do remember and enjoy a lot was Bridget Fonda following Robert De Niro in the parking lot and nagging him. And him turning around and going, please shut up. Please don't say anything else. Please stop talking, okay? Stop talking. And she continues and continues. And finally, in the parking lot in broad daylight, he pulls out a revolver and he shoots her in the stomach. And yep. I thought that that was genius. I thought that was brilliant.
Let me ask you this. When have you ever seen De Niro in another film in that type of artistic way where he acted so subduedly?
No, you're right. You're right. He was very subdued. And I'm trying to think of other, I'm thinking of all these films with him, and he's not necessarily a very subdued actor.
Correct.
But in Jackie Brown, you're right. He was probably directed by Tarantino to do that. Because Tarantino exactly. wants performances out of people that he wants. And he right. gets those performances.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, he absolutely does. He absolutely does. And that's, I think, again, I mean, that's what I go back to the brilliance of Jackie Brown. They played that whole film. And I wish I had a better adjective, but it was one of Quentin's quietest films. But that just means you need to turn your ear in a little bit and listen a little better.
Yeah.
And really watch the performance that he was able to get out of these very, very fine actors. You know, again, you've got an A-star list of people acting in a way that they had. Even Samuel L. Jackson in that one is not his typical over the top. He's funny as hell, but he's not his typical over the top.
Right.
And they all brought that to tell the adaptation of that story. And once again, you got Pam, the stellar queen, and she knocks it out of the park. She is Miss Badass in that film, and she rocks it.
Samuel L. Jackson's memorable line to me from Jackie Brown was mm-hmm. when you absolutely positively must kill every mother effer in the room, there is no substitute.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes.
That was great.
I mean, yes.
And it's so Tarantino.
We could literally actually do a whole nother episode just on Samuel L. Jackson's monologues in all the Tarantino films. That's another day. But he does get some of the best freaking lines in one of his films. My God.
Now, for time's sake, we're going to skip forward a little bit, and we'll go to two of my favorite films, Kill Bill Volume 1 and Kill Bill Volume 2. I mean, they're just, I got a smile on my face right now because they have everything. They have writing.
Yes.
They have directing. They have acting. They have music. They have everything that you want in a great movie. And, Uma Thurman is superb as the role of the bride, Beatrix Kiddo. and is just absolutely phenomenal in Kill Bill. And the story is just so good. You know, revenge stories are already incredible. You know what I mean? A revenge story is just always great. But she's got so much to be vengeful and want that revenge for, you know.
Well, 100%. And here's the deal. Uma's always good. But to tell the story, he needed to really make you immersed in that motley crew of characters. Because you had Daryl Hannah as L Driver, who, by the way, hands down, my favorite performance out of Daryl Hannah ever. You've got Bud being Michael Madsen. You got Vernita Green with Vivica A. Fox. And you got Oren Ishii.
Oren Ishii.
Being Lucy Liu.
That's right.
Oren Ishii. And she was... Uma's fantastic. Do not get me wrong. But my God, anytime Oren Ishii was on the scene, I couldn't take my eyes off Lucy Liu.
How about Lucy Liu's Oren Ishii's dialogue at the crime council? As your leader. That's how it begins. As your leader, I always encourage you to be able to give me any kind of feedback whatsoever. Unless, of course, it involves the topic that was just brought up here. If you speak of my Chinese American heritage in a negative is, I collect your effing head. Now, if any of you mother effers have anything else to say, now's the effing time. It's just,
oh my God.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant.
Yes, it is. Yes. Yes. Or when she's up after before the crazy 88s, and she's up on the top second level, as Uma's looking up at Oren Ishii, and very quietly, she just whispers, "You didn't think it was going to be that easy, did you?" And the bride looks up and says, "For a minute, I just thought."
Yeah.
Hand back to Oren Ishii, and she goes, "Silly rabbit."
Silly
Boom!
Rabbit.
Crazy 88s come rushing in.
Oh, just brilliant. And, you know, my other favorite scene was between L Driver and and the bride. And they are in Michael Madsen's trailer. They're in his trailer.
Yes.
And
yes.
And the bride has Hattori Hanzo steel. So she's using a samurai sword that is made by the finest samurai sword maker in the world. And L Driver looks down the hall at the bride and says, "In the very near future, that Hattori Hanzo blade will be mine." And she replies to her and says, "Bitch, you don't have a future." That was intensely great. Intensely great.
Yeah, and we haven't even touched on Carradine, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Carradine and his monologues were just incredible. And he played the role so well.
Yes.
Again, really, really
here's
loved
the deal. Yeah, and again, you're talking, and we're seeing a trend here, Mikey, right? Where you've got De Niro from Jackie Brown, very subdued, right?
Uh-huh.
And you've got over-the-top characters, don't get me wrong. You have Samuel L. Jackson, just like you said, when you need to kill
every mother effer in the room.
Exactly, you've got that. But let's talk about one of the last scenes between Carradine and Thurman. Does Carradine raise his voice once? No, it's a very subdued performance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's freaking intense and scary. And Tarantino gets that across on film. You've got blood, you've got guts, you've got eyes being ripped out, aka L Driver. You've got a lot of stuff happening. But when it comes down to the most intense scenes, just like you quoted with Ohrenishi, they're very quiet. They're very subdued.
Yes.
They pull the listener in. You have to lean forward to get into that scene. And yes. Tarantino was a master at that.
He was absolutely a master at that. And one of the things that I only found out recently was that there is an actor in, and I don't know if it's Kill Bill 1 or Kill Bill 2, but he plays the sheriff that discovers the bride after she's been shot. And he is a kind of not very well-known actor, but Quentin Tarantino absolutely loves him. And he plays two roles in the film. He plays the sheriff that finds the bride shot up. And at the end of the film, he plays the guy that talks like this to Uma Thurman to tell her where Bill actually is.
Yes.
He plays both characters. Oh my God.
You know what? Holy tamale. I did not realize that.
Same actor.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that great?
That's freaking phenomenal. Who does that?
I mean, he's so good. He's really good.
It's just, and again, talking about homages, you know, once again, you've got Gritty Crime with Jackie Brown. You've got literally Pulp Stories with Pulp Fiction. And now going into Kill Bill, his homage to Chop Suey films, right? I mean, the man is just, when he does something, he goes all in, right?
100%.
He goes all in.
100%.
Yeah.
Let's move on to what I think, in my opinion, is the most underrated Quentin Tarantino film, which is Death Proof.
Oh, really?
I think it's one of his most underrated films that he's done. I think that it involves the greatest car chase scene ever, ever put down on film. And you know,
that's a large claim, Mikey. I just need to put that out there, but okay.
I believe that it's the best car chase scene I've ever seen, with you know, Kurt Russell and Zoe Bell on the hood of that car, flying down the freeway or the highway or whatever, and almost falling off the roof of that car. I just thought it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I thought the story was great.
Yeah. It is. It's a fantastic story. I love, he goes in this totally, again, 70s homage.
Right.
to the action films. And he takes Death Proof. And once again, he plucks Kurt Russell. He hadn't been doing much during that time. Puts Kurt Russell into this phenomenal freaking role. And Zoe Bell, if people don't know who Zoe Bell is, Zoe Bell had always been his number one stunt person.
Right.
All of his female leads and characters. And Zoe Bell was so damn good that Quentin kept using her and going, okay, you need to be in the forefront.
Yeah.
Like, this, it's not good enough to have you in the background anymore. That's just, that won't do. You're that damn good. And you're right. That scene, it, like a lot of scenes, just sticks in your head. You've got everyone from Rosario Dawson in that film to Eli Roth to all of these fantastic character players. But, and again, the name. Yes, it's Kurt Russell, but who is Kurt Russell? He's Stuntman Mike.
Stuntman Mike. And through, you know, 95% of the film, Stuntman Mike is a badass. And he just emits like this strong cologne feel to him, you know? He's just got this real strong, you know, masculinity to him. And then at the end of the film, Zoe Bell runs up to his car with a pipe and starts to beat the hell out of him with the pipe. And he's crying in this over the top cry. You know, why do you do this? Why? And it's just unbelievably great. And, you know, so I Death Proof has a very special place in my heart.
All right. I'm, you know what? I'll go back and watch that. I'll have a different appreciation going back. I do like the film. It wasn't on my top three, but I would go back and watch that just for that scene that you.
Well, that
right
scene.
Now.
And then the other great scene is with Rose McGowan, where they're leaving in the Death Proof car, which, as we know, is designed to kill people, except for him. And they pull up to the interstate, and he says, "Which way are we going?" And she says, "Right, please." And he goes, "Well, that's too bad. You had a 50-50 chance of saying left, and you just didn't." And he puts the car in first gear and squeals out of that parking lot. And the look on Rose McGowan's face of pure terror is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Now,
his
next film, and a film that came out the same year, is one that we will always remember for its brilliant production. And it's the introduction to Christoph Waltz. And that is Inglourious Basterds.
Hell yeah.
And the first 10 minutes of that film are some of the greatest ever laid down on film. The interrogation scene.
Yeah.
He knows that he's hiding Jews underneath his home, and the way that he slow burns and slow plays that until he finally says, "You are harboring enemies of the state, are you not?" Oh. It's incredible.
That subdued performance. He gets that out of these actors, and that's almost terrifying when you see that scene, because you're nail biting the whole way.
Oh yeah. Right? Yes.
You know, I mean, Colonel Hans Landa. Again, you've got Christopher Waltz, who for me is just probably one of the finest actors ever to walk. You know, you got Daniel Day-Lewis, you got Christopher Waltz, you got all these people, but he just stands out. And what a hell of a performance. You can't forget Brad Pitt in that film. He's like you've never seen him before in that film.
He is.
And you've got Crazy Bear Eli Roth playing Sergeant Donnie, who is just the loose cannon, right?
Right.
Every single scene you see him in, whether he's carrying a bat or where he's carrying a gun, you're just like, oh, heads are going to roll.
Right.
Oh, okay. This is going to go down. And you're taking a very heavy subject. You're taking the Nazis, for criminy's sake.
Right.
And he's still getting freaking laughs, man. And he's reimagining history. What if, right? And you're just along for the ride. And why not? Because he makes, yes, it's gory. Yes, it's intense film content. However, you're going to be laughing your butt off along the
way. Oh, yeah.
You just are.
Yeah. I mean, Brad Pitt as, you know, Lieutenant Aldo Raine saying to Eli Roth, the bear, what do they call him? The bear Jew?
Yeah, the bear Jew.
The bear Jew. When Brad Pitt says to him, we have a, what does he say? He said, we have a prisoner who would like to die. Oblige.
Eli for himself. Coming out of the woodwork, just bringing that performance home.
Yeah.
Because I remember laughing my tail off watching in the, and that was a little awkward, kind of like your Pulp Fiction story. I remember being in the theater watching that film and having Eli Roth come out with the bat, and I am cracking up and no one else was laughing. Is that weird, Mikey?
No, it's not weird. It's a perfect reaction to a Quentin Tarantino tense scene that he can somehow write humor into.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, it's incredible. You know, him coming out with that baseball bat and battering that Nazi to death. It's great stuff. And his ability to write tension into scenes is uncanny. The way that Tarantino writes tension into scenes is just incredible. And he does it various times through the movie, including the bar scene where it's a standoff. And you're just how brilliant is it that he ends up, the shootout begins because when Michael Fassbender orders a drink, he orders it with three fingers the wrong way.
Yes!
You know, a real German would order three beers with his thumb and showing three fingers, one of them being his thumb. And that's the giveaway.
And that's just fascinating. That's the whole storytelling of it. You know, I think with Tarantino, he's very easy to write off as pop, kitschy, looking for an angle, over the top. No, I think something that you and I have both talked about through all of these films, that Death Proof, all of them, is there's so much thought behind it. And there's so much thought about creating the scene with these little intricacies, just like you talked about, that's why he's the fascinating maestro that he is.
Yeah.
That's why we delve in and talk about his stuff.
Yeah.
Like this.
Yeah. I mean, he just has such a gift for being able to write these kinds of things. And it's so fun to watch. Let's move on to Django Unchained.
Ooh.
Django Unchained was just a work of art.
Okay. See, the Tarantino universe, if you went back and really, really examined that, it fell into two camps. You either loved Django or you hated
it. Oh, I loved it. How about you? Where do you fall?
I'm a Western buff. So I got really, really excited. You had two things for me. You had a Western and you had Christoph again. And there's this fantastic interview that was done by the Hollywood Reporter with a round table of actors. And Jamie Foxx happened to be there. And he said, and the reporter was asking, what other actor have you learned the most from? And he said, during Django, it was Christoph Waltz. We're sitting there and it's a close-up scene, extremely intense. And Christoph takes a piece of paper out of his pocket and he goes to unfold it, reads it, and then goes back to fold it again, to unfold it, to thoughtfully read it again, give Jamie Foxx a look, and then tuck it back in his pocket. He said, this took 3 minutes. And he said, I knew right then I was in greatness. And the reporter said, and then what? And he said, and the Oscar goes to. It's really, this is what we're talking about here.
Right, right. And there's such iconic scenes from Django that you never forget, and performances that you never forget. Samuel L. Jackson in Django is just absolutely fantastic. And the shootout scene at the end where he's been shot in the leg, Samuel L. Jackson's been shot in the leg, and he says, Django, I am going to effing kill you, man. You are going to die, Django. You are going to die.
Oh my God.
Unbelievable.
Yes. There. Yeah. No, I mean, you had that as unbelievable. And I'm going to be honest with you. I think there was DiCaprio had acting chops. I think I'd seen it in glimmers here and there. I didn't really see it until him playing the Mississippi
Right.
plantation owner as
Calvin
Calvin
Candy.
Candy. Because Calvin Candy, again with the names, Tarantino, you're killing me with the character names. They're fantastic. But you're talking about this very ruthless, very prissy, very intense scene stealing that goes down between DiCaprio every single time he's on the scene, whether it's between him and Jamie Foxx or Christoph or whoever it is, and he chews it up. And it really for me went, oh wow, okay, I didn't have the respect for him as an actor until I saw him act in a Tarantino
Right.
film. Because you've got to be a special kind of actor to be able to deliver that dialogue,
Yes.
right? You got to sell it.
And he does.
And he did. And he did it again.
He
Yes.
does to the
Because he
fullest.
did it again in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He took that learning, that Tarantino learning school, and he applied it to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood,
Yeah.
for sure.
Yeah. Now, and we're going to get to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. In fact, we'll finish off with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And many people know this story, but if for those of you that don't, in Django, there's a scene where Leonardo DiCaprio smashes his hand down on a glass and cuts himself. And that was real.
Oh,
That wasn't acting. That
yep.
actually happened. He really did cut himself and continued with the scene. And the scene is still in the movie exactly as it was filmed. And it
Yep.
was incredible. It was just an incredible scene. And if you haven't seen Django, see it for just that reason. It's great acting and it's a great story. And it's just all around just a great movie. After Django
Yeah.
Unchained, came The Hateful Eight. Which I don't know about
Woo.
you, Nikki,
Sorry,
but
I
I
feel like
saw
it's.
that film in full 70 millimeter.
Oh,
Hell
you
yeah, I
damn
know
well
you
I did.
did.
I loved everything about this film. It's one of, and where you were saying that about Death Proof and Jackie Brown, how they were super underrated. I feel like Hateful Eight was the underrated, most underrated he ever put out. And again, it was one of his most quiet films. You're only talking about three different scenes that are filmed throughout that entire
Right.
movie. And really, it's all done in that cabin. And you, it's that whole film relies on
Yeah.
dialogue. You got nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
And if you want to see Tarantino really upping his game when it comes to fruitful dialogue,
Yeah.
that's your film. As far as I'm concerned, I'm not saying that everything else is chump change next to it, but I'm saying you want to see a film that's all about the conversation and people pulling that off. That is Hateful Eight. You have got Samuel L. Jackson and Kurt Russell and Jennifer Jason Leigh and Walter Goggins. You've got all Tim Roth, all Michael Madsen. I can keep going, but I should probably slow down. Bruce Dern. All of them. Sorry, because they're like all of my favorite actors in one room. It was like I couldn't have been happier. And it's Jennifer Jason Leigh playing this crazy criminal.
Yes.
Okay, that you're just like this is a fire starter bohemian woman that's coming in and taking over the
That's
room,
right.
and you've got charming Kurt Russell again going up in there. It's damn, that was a good film. I'm sorry, Mikey. I know you had an opinion. I just chewed
Well,
that
I
up.
do have a clip that we might be able to hear. I don't know how well we'll be able to hear it, but I do have a clip.
No one said the job's supposed to be.
All right.
No one said it's supposed to be that hard. No one said the job's supposed to be that hard. No one said the job's supposed to be easy. No one said it's supposed to be that hard, neither. That little lady, why they call him the hanger. When the handbill says dead or alive, the rest of us shoot you in the back, up on top of a perch somewhere, and bring you in dead over saddle. But when John Root, the hangman, catches you, you don't have no bullet in the back. Mm-hmm. When the hangman catches you, you hang.
I love that so much. I love that so much. Oh my God.
When John Root, the hangman, catches you, you're going to hang. That's good stuff.
And I love that. I love that.
I loved it down
are
to.
Going on to my most famous.
Go ahead.
No, go for it. I couldn't hear
that. I was going to say, he also uses Mario Anconi, who used to do all the spaghetti Western films, to do the score. And it's pretty, pretty good.
Yes. Now, you heard that backstory on that one,
not
right?
On Mario Anconi, no.
Okay, so Quentin really, really struggled with that. And the reason why is because typically prior to that, he had taken different snips of his original musical pieces and always pieced them together in a film, but had never asked a composer to do the entire film. And again, we're talking about Tarantino, like we did in the very beginning, where he very much handpicks the music and that's his deal. So you have to imagine that he was giving that over to someone else. And he did. And he has come out in several different interviews and articles to absolutely praise him because it was better than he could have ever imagined as an original score. And I couldn't agree more because it is chilling. If you really just kind of close your eyes at certain parts in that film,
it's chilling. And, you know, one other point that I wanted to make about The Hateful Eight is that as the film begins and they are rolling credits over the snow and you see this team of horses leading this wagon and it's going down and all the credits are rolling, many don't remember the fact that as the credits are rolling and they're showing you the different people that are in the movie, one of the names that comes up is Channing Tatum.
Yes!
And we don't see, and your mind forgets that you saw Channing Tatum because Channing Tatum doesn't show up until he explodes out of the bottom of the Minnie's haberdashery and starts shooting.
Right.
And that.
And how great was
brilliant.
That?
Oh. Absolutely brilliant. As is seriously. Russell, as is Kurt Russell's death. When Kurt Russell drinks the poison and goes, blah! And spits blood all over the bar table. That is quintessential Tarantino and just incredible. Just so awesome.
Yes. Yes.
Now we're almost at the end of this podcast. So let's get to his latest film, which was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. A movie that I think Nikki had more of an appreciation for than I did because
do you feel that way?
I felt like 95% of the movie was not a typical Quentin Tarantino film and that the last 15 minutes of it are. Maybe I got to go back and take another look, but I know that you loved Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I was a little bit underwhelmed.
Okay. Well, here's a couple things about me going into it, number one. Number two, I obviously, as you do, have a love and penchant for Hollywood, for film and all that kind of stuff, and I really saw this film as Tarantino's love letter to Hollywood. That's really how I watched the entire film. Number two, I'm not meaning to scare you or anything, but I do have a little bit of an obsession with serial killers. And I'm not going to lie. I'm just going to be really honest about it. I mean, I embrace that about myself. And so the fact that he took, again, a reimagining of history when it comes to the Tate and LaBianca murders, it was astounding to me. And he really gave life to Sharon Tate. Sharon Tate, unfortunately, God bless, but has obviously was a victim of the Manson family. But because she died so young and died so right as her bright shining star was about to explode in Hollywood, she's always the victim and never a person. And in this film, Tarantino made her a full
and see,
person.
I was a on person. The other side of that. I felt like Margot Robbie's portrayal of Sharon Tate was underwhelming. So we are on different sides of the aisle, as it were, on her performance as Sharon Tate.
I got you. I see, and I loved that part of it, but I also loved, and maybe again, it's a close to my heart kind of thing, but I really, really loved DiCaprio and Pitt. DiCaprio being Rick Dalton and Brad Pitt being Cliff Booth. I loved their very human struggles with aging in Hollywood. There's the perfect scene where DiCaprio has his 10-year-old co-star and he's talking about a book and he just starts breaking down completely. And it's really about how he's aging in Hollywood and his career and what happens. Just like Pitt being shunned in Hollywood, aging as a stuntman. Really, it was about kind of him killing his wife. But moving on from that, I mean, if you just take that to the side, it's a really phenomenal film. And then you got Tarantino, really, as you said, in the last 15 minutes, because it went berserk so quick. But I will say this, my favorite part of the whole film, was when Brad Pitt goes to Spawn Ranch.
Wait a minute. You cut out there. Say that again.
Is when Brad Pitt went to Spawn Ranch.
Got it.
Because to be honest with you, I would have watched a whole Tarantino film just on that.
Yeah.
Just Brad Pitt at Spawn Ranch. Done. I'll pay my ticket. I'll go see it. It was leery and eerie and how he portrays the Manson family. It was... I just gobbled it up.
Yeah, and I will agree with you on that. I think that the portrayal of the Manson family was not over the top because I know a lot about serial killers as well, and that one really, that particular, you know, the Manson murders really got me. They're so eerie. And he didn't make it weird. Tarantino didn't make it weird. And he rewrote history with Sharon Tate living. And I thought that that was fantastic. I was glad he did. And I thought it was an interesting take. So, you know, maybe I liked it more than I'm, as I'm talking about it, it sounds like I like it. And maybe I did like it more than I realize. But anyway, we're at the hour point, and for our first podcast, Nikki, I think it went pretty good, and I think we had a lot of fun looking at the work of Quentin Tarantino.
Absolutely, and I hope everyone out there will give him a shot with any one of the loves of the films that we just talked about.
Yeah, he really is great, and he's one of the greatest filmmakers of, you know, our lifetimes, and I can't wait to see what he does next. Now we're going to end, and this is Nikki's idea. We're going to end each podcast with this question. Go ahead, Nikki.
What are you watching right now, Mikey?
I am watching Killing Eve, which is my favorite television show of all time. used to be Breaking Bad. And okay. It is now okay. Killing Eve with Sandra Oh and Jodie Comer. And the reason that I think mm-hmm. the show is incredible, it's about a female assassin in Europe. And Sandra Oh works for MI6, which is their version of the British version of the CIA. And Jodie Comer plays a assassin named Villanelle. And she is absolutely, unbelievably terrific. So that's what I'm watching. What are you watching right now?
It is. And Mikey, just to conclude on that, I think you can stream that on Hulu, right?
Yeah, you,
is that
yeah,
where
yep,
you're watching
it's on
it?
Hulu.
Okay. Just so anybody out there is wondering, well, how do I get a hold of that? Yes, check it out on Hulu. Me, I am freaking immersed right now in three seasons of the Netflix show Kingdom. Now, this was an original Audience Network show, aired from 2014 to 2017. This is about a family of mixed martial art fighting. Okay, out of Venice, California, starring Frank Grillo and Matt Loria, Jonathan Tucker, and get this, Nick Jonas. No, I did
no,
say
she
Nick
did
Jonas
say Nick
as
Jonas.
An MMA fighter. And I did say Nick Jonas. And dude, if I see Nick Jonas down the street, I'm gonna be a little scared. I'm not gonna lie to you. I'm not that man knows how to throw a punch. This is Kylie Sanchez as Lisa, the female counterpart to all of these rock star guys, but it takes place and then it's really, really addressing the warrior spirit, what it takes in a human spirit, not just as a person, as a man, as a person to step into that ring and to you're getting paid to get beat yeah. up. All right. What does that do to you? What does that do to and, you and the human spirit? And it's amazing, man. It's like eating pop.
And you know what? Nick,
it explodes in your mouth and you want it again.
Nikki recommended it. And I watched the first episode and enjoyed it. And I will continue to watch it. And it is good. She's not wrong about that. Kingdom is good. And so you can find that on Netflix. My suggestion is Killing Eve, which you can find on Hulu. And I think that's going to wrap it up for Through the Lens with Mikey and Nikki for this week. Nikki, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast and for your knowledge. And we'll come back at it next week and we'll do another one.
Thank you so much, Mikey.
All right.
Take
we'll
care.
See you, Nikki. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.